Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, I'm Mark Riley.
And I'm Rob Hughes.
And you're listening to the A to Z of David Bowie,
the greatest rock and roll star in the world, ever, ever.
K is for Lindsay Kemp.
Lindsay Kemp, born 3rd of May 1938 near Liverpool. His father, Norman, was a naval officer who'd met and married Marie Gilmore in South Shields on the northeast coast. Norman and Marie's first child had been a daughter named Norma, who died from meningitis at the age of five. So Lindsay was conceived very much to take his sister's place for her inconsolable mother.
Yeah, what a tragedy. Yeah. So along with her costumes and the miniature Japanese kimonos and fans her father had brought back from the Orient, he also inherited his sister's talent for dancing and entertaining, so he really was kind of like filling the role, wasn't
yeah,
he?
Yeah, you know? Sure.
But 2.5 years later, tragedy struck again. Norman's ship was struck by a German torpedo, and he was not amongst the survivors.
Wow. According to Kemp, he danced from early childhood. He said, I'd dance on the kitchen table to entertain the neighbours. I mean, it was a novelty in South Shield to see a little boy in full makeup dancing on point. Finally, it got a bit too much for my mother and she decided to send me to boarding school at the age of 8, hoping it would knock some sense into me.
Yeah, I mean, you would have to say, wouldn't you, doing all of this in South Shields at that point in time is a pretty brave. I mean, he's a kid and he's just following his instinct and his heart,
yeah.
And it's so brilliant. But it must have been quite awkward for his mum just to get to grips with exactly what was going on.
Yeah, it sounds a bit like a template for Billy Elliot, this, doesn't it?
Yeah, I know what you mean, actually, mate. Yeah, so Kemp's mother moved away from South Shields and Kemp attended Bearwood College near Wokingham, a school for the sons of merchant seamen. And he used to dance in working men's clubs in a very feminine kind of way, which didn't go down well. That's what it says here.
No kidding.
This just shows the courage of him.
Yeah.
He and his mother later moved to Bradford, Yorkshire, where Kemp attended Bradford Art College before studying dance with Hilda Holger and a mime artist called Marcel Marceau.
Wow, okay.
Which is, you're right at the very top of it there. If you can't learn the trade from Marcel Marceau, then you can't learn it.
Give up mime, I'd say. In the late 50s, living in London and usually penniless, Kemp's apprenticeship consisted of dancing with various small but ambitious dance groups, including the John Broome Dance Theatre. He'd also studied with Broome in Bradford earlier than that. The Hilda Holger Company, as mentioned, and the Charles Weedman Company on his visits to London. His unquenchable thirst for performing meant that he was very enthusiastic about appearing in numerous short-lived shows of all kinds. So he really learnt on the job. So he just learned by performing and what he liked and what he didn't like.
Yeah, well, it was in him, wasn't it? It was just in him. So in 1960, he made his London West End debut in the chorus line of Terry Rattigan's musical Joie de Vivre at the Queen's Theatre, and this was followed by a long provincial tour of Oklahoma. I put the question mark in there, where he was an unlikely but eye-catching chorus cowboy. I bet he was.
Oh, okay.
Brilliant.
On returning to London, he teamed up with two female friends to form a cabaret act. They called themselves the Trio Lindsay. Then he formed his own dance company in the early 60s and first attracted attention with an appearance at the Edinburgh Festival in 1968.
Okie dokie. So his stage performances include
Poirot in Turquoise,
which we'll just call a clown show from here on in, Flowers,
Salome,
Mr. Punch Pantomime,
Mr. Punch's Pantomime, and A Midsummer Night's Dream, and many more.
Yeah, okay.
Most of these works in collaboration with the composer Carlos Miranda.
Okay, so he staged and performed in David Bowie's Ziggy Stardust concerts at the London Rainbow Theatre in August 1972, and with Jack Birkett appears in the promotional video for Bowie's single John I'm Only Dancing, which was, as we know, directed by Mick Rock. Kemp's film roles included a support role in Kate Bush's short film The Line, The Cross and The Curve in 1994, a dancer and cabaret performer in Derek Jarman's Sebastian and Jubilee, retrospectively, a pantomime dame in Todd Haynes' Velvet Goldmine, and the pub landlord Alder McGregor in Anthony Schaefer's The Wicker Man.
Now, it's strange casting that, because it's a very camp role that he's playing there, and he's supposed to be the father of Britt Eklund.
The pub landlord. But what a film. It's one of those films where you have to say, if you could have a cameo in a British film, that'd have to be on your list. It's classic.
We were on holiday in Scotland last year, and we, unbeknownst to us, we were very, very close to all the filming locations for The Wicker Man, so we decided to make it, we trawled across all of them, even to the site on the coast where the big Wicker Man originally was constructed and all the rest of it, and went to the pub where Lindsay Kemp was supposedly the landlord.
Wow.
It was amazing.
That's impressive.
During the early 70s, Kemp was a popular and inspirational teacher of dance and mime. So, of course, you go Bowie and Kate Bush were amongst his students. Kate Bush later wrote the song Moving, which appeared on her debut album, The Kick Inside, as a tribute to Kemp. In 1979, he left England for Spain and then Italy. And by 2002, he had homes in Rome and Todi.
Where's Todi?
That's in Perugia.
Is it really?
Italy,
you've done
yes.
some research
so
here, haven't you, Bob?
That, Mark.
You cheeky boy.
I wanted to Google it, see how you pronounced it.
Good man. Okay. So his filmography. The Vampire Lovers. I love that film, 1970. I didn't know he was in that.
Yeah. Why do you love that film?
I just love it. Yeah. He's a jester in that, apparently.
He is, yeah. Savage Messiah, 1972, was Angus Corky.
Okay, The Wicker Man, as we know, Aldo McGregor.
He plays top star in The Stud in 74.
A dancer in Sebastian, mentioned.
A cabaret performer in Jubilee, as mentioned.
A mortician in Valentino.
He's in A Midsummer Night's Dream for TV as Puck in 1985.
Okay, Cartoline Italiane. What's that?
I think that translates as Italian postcards, Mark.
Oh, does it right?
Yeah, 1987. Beautifully put, though. He's also in The Line, The Cross and The Curve, as mentioned, as the guide.
Yeah, Velvet Goldmine, 1998, as a pantomime dame.
And he makes various guest appearances in the Spanish TV show La Mandragora in 2005 and 6.
So we'll look at the David Bowie timeline now then, eh? Okay, so the 4th of August 1967. And now, again, as always, we need to mention Kevin Kahn and we need to mention the book Any Day Now. And if you were interested enough in David Bowie to listen to this podcast, A, thank you very much. B, give it a review. A good review. Yes. And also, just go and get Any Day Now. There's lots of great books out there. Nick Pegg's Complete David Bowie. David Buckley's book also as well, Strange Fascination, which we've mentioned these before, but they are great. But Any Day Now, it's just compelling stuff. So, yeah, the 4th of August, 1967. Accompanied by Michael Garrett on piano, mime artist Lindsay Kemp begins a two-week run of his new show, Clown's Hour, at the Little Theatre, St. Martin's Lane in Covent Garden. During the interval, David's album is played, and he's informed by his girlfriend Jan, who is Ken Pitt's secretary, who persuades him to attend a lunchtime performance. Now, how pivotal is this work from Jan? You know, because what he was about to see was to help shape his following career, as we know. So, Jan, wherever you are, we all need to buy you a drink.
Yeah, we salute you, definitely. I mean, you can't underestimate Lindsay Kemp's influence on Bowie in these formative years, can you? After the show, David and Jan visit Kemp in his dressing room. The singer and the mime artist are bowled over by each other's personalities. Not long after, David joins Kemp's movement classes at the Covent Garden Dance Theatre, and they soon conspire to work together. Kemp later said that Bowie told him at this time, get this, that he planned on becoming a Buddhist monk and moving to a monastery in Scotland.
Yeah, I remember all this. Maybe, I wasn't there at the time, but I remember reading it before.
Absolutely, yeah, well put. Maybe it was because of his new interest in mime that he didn't really take this route, in which case, let's get Jan two lots of drinks.
Definitely.
Yeah? Kemp said, I told him, you can give yourself to God and to me and the public at one and the same time, which he did for a bit.
Right, okay. Bowie then tracked Kemp down to his house. He's done this before, hasn't he? With various people, where they just turn up at the houses, knock on the door, and they're like, oh, hello. But anyway, it was at my home in Bateman Buildings in Soho. I just remember him being there. I felt a bit like the Virgin Mary confronted by this vision of the Archangel Gabriel, glowing, shining, incredibly beautiful, and immediately inspiring. And Bowie later recalled that his flat was above a strip club, and strippers would regularly pop up for cups of sugar. He said it was a circus. I joined a circus.
Brilliant. He also said, dear old Lindsay, Lindsay was a trip and a half. I've never known anyone commit suicide so many times. He lived on his emotions. He was a wonderful influence. His day-to-day life was the most theatrical thing that I'd ever seen.
So Kemp, on Bowie's early appearances at his classes, he says, David was a huge hit with the ladies, especially during the improvisations. Improvising sailors drowning at sea, animals hunting the prey. Those ladies would have devoured him like the Maniads during Dionysus. He seemed quite pleased about all that and came back for another class.
I bet he did.
No stopping him.
Yeah, no brainer there. So to November and early December 67, and Bowie is now rehearsing for his appearance in Kemp's Poirot, let's say Clowns in Turquoise, yeah, which is due to open in Oxford at the end of December. Bowie's character is called Cloud. Well, I suppose you'd have to be, wouldn't it?
Would be, wouldn't it?
Costume designer Natasha Kornilov said Kemp told her that Bowie was a bit stiff, but I think we could do something with him.
They did. They also let him build the props for the show, which was big of him. And during this period, Bowie was also busy with his pop career. So he was recording sessions for the BBC and still keeping an eye on his pop career, obviously. One review for The Clown Show by A. Young in the Financial Times reads thus: David Bowie is a young pop star whose songs tend to follow ambition beyond the boundaries of his talent.
Ooh.
Ouch. I am on his side because, amongst other reasons, he sings without a microphone. What does that mean, Bob?
I've no idea, Bob. Right, okay. Apart from he can project his voice a bit.
Maybe.
Again, yeah, drawing from Kevin Can's Any Day Now here, you'll find this intriguing sentence. In the new year, the production is to move to Rosehill Theatre, an events performance base in Moresby near Whitehaven in Cumbria, where there's to be as much drama offstage as on it, as David becomes entangled with both Kemp and Kornilov.
Right, OK, so the plot thickens, yeah.
From Kevin Can's book here, this is a contemporary review of that show. Presented as the centrepiece attraction of the Oxford Young Playhouse Association's recent Christmas programme, The Clown Show gave Lindsay Kemp, whose work as the dwarf in Frank Hauser's production of Volpone is still vividly remembered in Oxford, ample opportunities to display his impressive mimetic skill. Mimetic? That's a new one on me.
It's a good one.
As the clown pursues an invisible Columbine, his presence is, however, subtly and often strongly suggested, entranced by his acquisition of a new and resplendent coat, wrongly and viciously accused of theft, in trouble with authority and in many other moods and situations, Mr. Kemp gives versatile proof of the flexible power of the wordless theatre. In more broadly comic vein, his impression of a striptease performer is informed with the same disciplined bodily plasticity and, if it were, silent wit. David Bowie, the show's inventive composer, makes several striking appearances as Cloud, a multi-purposed and multi-guised character, and Jack Burkett is a compelling Harlequin. The decor and costumes of Natasha Kornilov, already much admired in Oxford as a designer for several recent Playhouse productions, brings much visual delight in terms of colour to the simple curtain setting, and her masks give keen dramatic point to the action. In these days of mass media entertainment, it's heartening to sense the successful impact which this, one of the oldest forms of living theatre, is having upon a predominantly young audience, many of whom are making their first acquaintance with the ageist art of mime. It goes on to say the Oxford Young Playhouse Association are to be congratulated on their enterprise in presenting Mr. Kemp's entertainment, which is shortly to be seen in London.
Right, OK, so the thumbs up in the suburbs.
Certainly.
Well read, Bob. And we'll continue here. Kemp allegedly, we can see this coming, becoming jealous of how close Bowie and Kornilov had become. At one point, whilst the production was in Cumbria, Kemp is rushed to hospital with slashed wrists. He returns to the production with bandaged wrists, which eventually start to show blood, something the audience were more than slightly perplexed about. Kemp said, much of the time I spent with David Bowie was bloody painful. The 6th of January, 1968, the production leaves Cumbria with a growing confidence, but skint.
But skint, yeah. At this point, Kemp is invited to appear in a BBC play called The Pistol Shot, which he accepts. And in turn, he invites Bowie along to perform in the dance scene. So this is where Bowie met Hermione Farthingale, wasn't it? Which is, you know, we sort of generally consider Bowie's first true love. And let's be honest, you know, if Kemp is going to be jealous about this couple, this can't have helped, can it? Because after filming, they went off together, sort of not quite hand in hand, but more or less down to the tube station with Kemp kind of sadly looking on.
Well, you know, he probably thinks, all right, I'll divert Bowie away from Natasha here. This is gonna be good. This. And then he invites him to the TV program and introduces him to Hermione Farthingale.
Yes,
so just, yeah, poor fella. So 16th of March sees the run of The Clown Show at London's Mercury Theatre come to an end. So it starts a short run at the Intimate Theatre in London. Perhaps inevitably, due in no small part to Bowie falling head over heels with Hermione, Ian Kemp wouldn't work together again for a couple of years.
So this takes us to 1970, doesn't it? 29th of January 1970, to be exact. Bowie's in Scotland for a solo performance on a programme called Cairngorm Sky Night.
Right.
Wonder if that still exists?
I doubt it, mate.
It doesn't. And the show at Aberdeen University. At the same time, Kemp is performing in Edinburgh for a TV version of The Clown Show, and Bowie is invited back to the production, which he gladly accepts. For much of the performance, Bowie sits on top of a stepladder. Now, obviously, this was required, but you make you think, was it kind of Kemp having a little kind of dig at it, trying to get back to him in some way, perhaps?
Maybe he was on the naughty step.
Mm.
Okay, so another 2 years pass after this. Bowie now having had a hit with Starman, so he's famous and he's got the world at his feet. And the ambitious three-night stint at London's Rainbow Theatre goes into rehearsals at the same venue. 10th of August 1972, Lindsay Kemp is brought back from his new home in Scotland by Angie, okay, to turn the rock show into a theatrical Ziggy spectacle. And 3 days of intensive rehearsals take place with a whole entourage Saturday 19th of August for three legendary nights.
Of course, yeah. The show was a massive success, as we know. The onstage antics of Lindsay Kemp and his five fellow artists running around scaffolding and plinths, all right? So if you look at the stage set, it is wildly ambitious.
Yeah.
A prototype was basically for what was to follow. You have to say, it really does look closer to, well, you mentioned this, a McAlpine building site. You know, it's kind of a little bit kind of experimental theatre, isn't it?
It is scaffolding. I mean, yeah. But then again, even if you think about, from what I can tell, and I never saw the tour, but from the Diamond Dogs tour, that looks like a bit like scaffolding and stuff. The plinth that Bowie walks across, yeah, doesn't look that far away. It looks quite stark. So,
yeah, so you know,
it's not derogatory, but it does look like a little bit like a building site.
Yeah, but you can see Bowie scoping out the idea, can't you, later on for the Diamond Dogs and all the rest of it. And of course, you'd want to see it, wouldn't you? I would, certainly.
Okay, so on the Rainbow shows, this is what Lindsay Kemp says. The set was inspired by 1920s constructivism. We assembled a set with various platforms, which David would very energetically clamber over, sometimes doing costume changes up the ladder. He's on the ladder again, of his own choice, from one platform to another. My company were all in the show, perched on different levels, wearing masks. It was very high up. I was terrified, as I've got a fear of heights. David emerged looking marvellous, out of a lot of dry ice, and the audience went crazy. I'd never performed in or directed a show in such a vast venue, and so I was credited with marrying the theatre to rock and roll.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently, Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
The A to Z of David Bowie with Mark Riley and Rob Hughes.
K is for Kempit.
Kempit, you cannot overstate Kempit's influence on David Bowie. So this is drawn from his All Music biography. Kenneth Pitt, best remembered as David Bowie's manager from about 1967 to 1970, though his client left him right after getting his first hit, Space Oddity. As Kit managed Bowie during the singer's most pop and theatre influence phase, some critics have painted him as an old school manager who's trying to help mould Bowie into an all-round entertainer. Well, you know, you've got to say, Bowie wasn't averse to that idea by the sound of it.
That's exactly what Bowie wanted,
yeah,
wasn't
exactly.
It? I mean, we know full well that he wanted to be a pop star, but he also wanted to be a Svengali, and he also wanted to do mime, and he also wanted to be in theatre. So, yeah. Don't blame Ken.
You can't blame Ken. It says with the art of Bowie finally finding himself when he left Pitt and pioneering glam rock, Pitt kind of moulded Bowie in so many ways.
Yeah, it's a great story, and he seems like a genuinely brilliant fellow,
but we'll
get into all that later. And in his defence, actually, Pitt was not inherently averse to straight rock music, managing several rock artists, most notably Manfred Mann. Pitt withdrew from artist management into other parts of the entertainment business after losing Bowie and wrote at length length about his relationship with Bowie in his book, Bowie, The Pitt Report. And he was very, very fond of David Bowie, wasn't he? So in the 50s, Pitt did publicity for American artists touring England, such as Frank Sinatra and Duke Ellington, and eventually rock acts like Jerry Lee Lewis.
Yeah, he'd entered artist management in the 50s with a gypsy singer, Danny Purchase, but his first memorable star client was the band Manfred Mann. He aided in their success by encouraging them to record their big hit, Do Wah Diddy Diddy, but the group dropped him in 65. In the mid-60s, he also handled affairs for one of the few all-women rock bands of the era, Goldie and the Gingerbreads, and the folk-pop singer Crispian St. Peter's.
Yeah, and you know, I mean, if you look at Kemp here from the distance, but, you know, and I've heard him speak and everything, you'd have to say he's cut from the same cloth probably as Brian Epstein.
Yeah, I mean, I know when Bob Dylan first came over for his first tour of the States, it was Ken Pitt doing the promo with him, you know.
Yeah, he's a very influential man, and we will drop a real humdinger in a short while. But anyway, in late 1965, Pitt was approached by Ralph Horton, previously discussed, then managing Davy Jones, who had yet to change his name to Davy Bowie, who was in search of a managerial partner. Now, this is because of some difficulties in it, in finances. We've done that. When Pitt finally saw Bowie in 1966, he was impressed and did share managerial duties with Horton for a while before he was officially taken on as Bowie's sole manager in April 1967. Bowie's recordings in the Pitt era, particularly those of 1966 to 68, are often savaged by rock critics for their Faye Anthony Newley influence and light, sometimes invisible traces of actual rock and roll. Again, that was what Bowie was mad on, Anthony Newley.
It was.
And more so than Ken Pitt, as
yeah.
I'm aware.
He wanted to be Anthony Newley, didn't he? So as Pitt was also working to help Bowie make inroads into theatre and film, some have felt the manager was trying to get his protege into the mainstream entertainment world, which isn't a bad thing. That shouldn't be a destructive thing.
No, not necessarily, but it seems to be slightly weighted against Ken Pitt in this biography.
Yeah,
but,
sure.
But this is, to be fair, this is often how he's seen, and we'll hopefully correct some of it.
Yeah, hopefully. So writing in an illustrated record, which is the first Bowie book I ever got, by Roy Carr and Charles Shaw Murray of The Enemy, they say, in his last attempt to conform to Kenneth Pitt's demands and expectations, Bowie participated in two continental song festivals, one in Malta, one in Italy, held in August of 1969, performing When I Live My Dream from the first album.
Right, OK. So while Pitt may not have been the most suitable manager for Bowie in the long term, that's probably true. In his defence, it should be pointed out that he did a great deal for the singer in his early career. And again, it was mentioned previously that Tony DeFries did call an audit on Ken Pitt's accounts for David Bowie, just wondering if he'd been, you know, secreting money away and stuff. And they found out that Ken Pitt had been undercharging David Bowie.
Yeah.
It was quite the opposite,
yes.
So bless him. First of all, he helped sustain him with money and encouragement. Yep, at a time when Bowie was failing to make any commercial headway in pop, accumulating 5 years of failures before Space Oddity, a song which also Ken Pitt had a hand in instigating.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, yeah, you know.
Also, of course, the Anthony Newley phase was not something that Pitt forced upon Bowie, as discussed. It was one of the many transitions that Bowie went through, albeit not a particularly successful commercial one. And this is why Bowie got that awful reputation as being the chameleon of rock, wasn't it? Because he went through all these different transitions, you know, and just picking up lots of influences and dropping them at times.
Under the influence of his wife, Angie, Bowie grew more distant from Pitt after Space Oddity, and by the early 70s, Pitt had been dumped in favour of Tony DeFries, main man. In Todd Haynes' movie, Velvet Goldmine, a fictionalised treatment of glam rock, the early manager of the star, Brian Slade, was based largely on Kenneth Pitt.
Meanwhile, the character Cecil seems largely based on Kenneth Pitt, although the caricature makes him out to be a more pathetic and ineffectual figure than Pitt likely ever was. Pitt abandoned artist management to concentrate upon consulting work with foreign acts touring the UK.
Now, at this point in time, we've both heard an interview between Paul Morley and Ken Pitt. And I think it's from, is it from like 1984?
I'm guessing when, just because the Pitt Report came out in 83, didn't it? So I'm guessing it was promotion for that.
Yeah, okay. And Paul, it has to be said, Paul Morley seems really aggressive towards Ken Pitt, who just retains a very gentlemanly-like status right throughout. He does amazingly, because he's quite antagonistic, Paul Morley.
Yeah,
and it's hard to work out why. But Paul Morley's going, and I think Paul Morley's angle is a bit like, oh, you're jumping on the Bowie bandwagon, because Bowie was massive at this point in time.
Yeah, of course.
You know, and we know he wasn't a leech of Bowie's career anyway. We've already found that much out. He was saying, so you just released an autobiography now. What a coincidence. I think that was what Paul Morley was
getting
at.
Well, I think he was getting at the gist step, one of the things that I think he was trying to say was, you know, why would anybody be interested in what Bowie was doing before he got famous? And of course, you know, everybody wants to know that stuff, don't they, really? You know, the ins and outs of how he shaped himself.
That's the thing you really want to know. I mean, everybody knows what Bowie was up to after 1972, don't they? They know, I mean, if you've got any day now, you certainly know day by day. But anyway, I mean, yeah, his life was very public. So the stuff that led up to it before, particularly if you consider how confusing it was, which we talked about before with, you know, the various albums being re-released with a Ziggy cut on it. So you've got, you know, a David Bowie being re-released as Space Oddity with the ginger spiky hair on it. You've got the World of David Bowie with the curly cover, and you've got the Bowie, the same album with the Ziggy cut.
Yeah.
So you did need to know all of these things, and you needed to know where Laughing Gnome came from in the middle of Ziggy and all that kind
of
stuff.
Yeah, of course. I remember buying the Pip Report for that reason, because it was all kind of smoke and mirror. You know, obviously pre-internet days here.
Yeah.
So you're just trying to find out bits and bobs about Bowie's back catalogue and his biography that you perhaps couldn't really piece together.
And it is dry and it is spotty, but it serves a purpose. But Ken Pitt's reply to Paul Morley was great. He said it's not an autobiography, it's a report. And it is called the, you know, the report.
Yeah.
It's the Pitt Report. So, I mean, there's no doubt about it. And you know, again, talking about Kevin Camp, and he's done so much stuff with Bowie. We can talk about other stuff apart from any day now. But he's a mate of Ken Pitt's. Okay.
Right.
And he's told me some amazing things about him, and he knows him better than anybody else that I've ever spoken to.
Right.
And he says he's a wonderful man and a really generous and kind fella. And we will believe him 1,000%.
Yeah.
And okay. And so uncredited for so many things.
So let's pick up on the Bowie timeline here, according again to Any Day Now. Wednesday, 15th of September 1965, Ralph Horton visits Ken Pitt at his offices in Curzon Street to discuss whether Pitt is interested in becoming interested in the lower third, Bowie's band, and David in particular. Pitt's never even heard of Bowie, and he says that his client list is full, but agrees to attend a performance pretty soon. Pitt also advises Horton to persuade David to change his stage name.
So, a great move already. He wisely suggested this because Davy Jones, yet to be a member of the Monkees, but already having made his name playing the Artful Dodger on Broadway production of Oliver, is becoming famous. So, Friday the 17th of September.
So this is the wording of the letter written by Ralph Horton to Ken Pitt about Bowie's stage name change, all right? So he said, "Dear Ken, may I say I enjoyed our meeting the other day and it was indeed a pleasure to be introduced to you. I've taken the liberty of writing to you and advising you I've now changed Davy's name to David Bowie. In the meantime, I look forward to hearing from you with any suggestions you may have, and I'll forward to you, as suggested, a copy of the record when they become available. Yours sincerely, Ralph Horton."
Right, so good work. At Ken Pitt's instruction.
Yes.
So Sunday, the 21st of August, 1966, Bowie plays the marquee with the buzz, and Ken Pitt is hatching a plan to turn Bowie into a star of stage and screen.
20th of October now, 1966, Bowie and the buzz play in Southampton, and Pitt goes to see Tony Hall, who was head of promotion at Decca at that point, and he plays Hall an acetate of Rubber Band, which really impresses Hall. He says, "I must say, I just flipped. This guy had such a different sound, such a different approach." And he also went to see Hugh Mendel, who was then the artist manager at Decca, wasn't he? Very influential figure, and the man who signed the Rolling Stones. He also liked what he heard, and another meeting was arranged for Mendel to hear more of Bowie's stuff.
Right, 24th of October, Pitt meets Hugh Mendel again in the company of producer Mike Vernon, who's an important character in Bowie's career, on the strength of the recordings of The Gravedigger and London Boys. And Mendel offers Pitt a recording contract for David with the Decca offshoot DRAM. So already Ken Pitt has started to move Bowie's career along at a pace, hasn't
he? Yeah, definitely. 25th of November now, meeting with his backing band, The Buzz, at Ken Pitt's office. The musicians are told there's no money to pay them, but instead of leaving, they offer to carry on working for free. The band fizzled out, of course, even though they're already recording Bowie's debut album.
Yeah, it's pretty sad all that, wasn't it? So December 1966, famously Ralph Horton, still co-managing Bowie with Pitt, secures a £500 publishing contract with Essex Music. This despite the fact that Pitt has already agreed a £1,000 deal with the possibility of a £30,000 publishing deal overtaking both of these agreements. So, there's little chinks in the armour there, isn't
there? Yeah, that liaison was never going to last, was it? So the 16th of December now, 1966, Ken Pitt returns from his overseas trip to the States. This is a pivotal moment as well. Among his presents for David is a test pressing of the album The Velvet Underground and Nico, given to him personally by Andy Warhol during a visit to Warhol's studio, The Factory, in November.
Yeah, so with the name Warhol scrawled on the label, this becomes one of Davey's most treasured possessions. So Bowie, in 2002, the first track glided by innocuously enough and didn't really register. However, from that point on, with the opening, throbbing, sarcastic bass, love that, and guitar of I'm Waiting for the Man, the linchpin, the keystone
milestone of my ambition was driven home.
Yeah, big light bulb goes on there. So, Ken Pitt did make an impression on Bowie with this gift, which has, you know, been unequalled by any other manager he had before or since, it has to be said.
Well, this is a story that Kevin Can told me. So, Ken Pitt went over to America, and he went over because he wanted to look after the Velvet Underground interests in the UK. So, it wasn't a case that he just brought this record back and wasn't aware of what it was. He loved them. And the story that floored me, that Kevin told me, was the fact that he has seen the paperwork which involves bringing the Velvet Underground over from New York to London in 1967 to do a performance at the Roundhouse.
Wow.
And there is visa documents there. There's also all of the passport details for all of the Velvet Underground, the whole kit and caboodle, bringing them over with Andy Warhol. Mm. The BBC apparently were also supposed to be running Warhol films.
Right.
So it was just going to be a massive, massive art event, which would have, I mean, people now still talk about the Doors playing at the Roundhouse. If the Velvet Underground had to come over in 1967, I don't even know how quickly that would have changed the whole face of music over here. It might have come and gone, but it might have been one of those really massively explosive nights that really just sets everybody
off.
Because the cliche being that, you know, not many people bought the Velvet Underground's first album, but everybody who did went out and formed a band.
Yeah.
Lord knows if there was like 3,500 people watching them in London that night as they were doing all of that really, really unbelievable, crazy, edgy stuff, what kind of an effect that would have had on the British music scene.
I'm guessing too, with all the light shows as well, this would be the whole caboodle, wouldn't it? Plastic exploding, inevitable, all that stuff. So what made that not happen? You know?
I'm not sure. One day, I mean, hopefully Kevin will you know, release another book or an annex to one of his previous publications, and the story will come out. But that floored me, that, because that's such an amazing story and shows again, you know, that Ken Pitt really was committed to the Velvet Underground thing and understood it.
And a visionary, you know?
Yeah, and somebody who's perceived to be so square.
Exactly.
You know, embracing who were the band that were the most out there band in the world at that point in time.
Without a doubt.
So, January 1967, Bowie becomes disillusioned in Horton's managerial ability and looks towards engaging Pitt solely as his manager. Horton, well in debt by this time, was more than happy to disappear from the scene.
And disappear he did.
Yeah, we can hear him.
Oh, there goes Ralph.
There we go.
Toddling down the road. They became very close over the following months. This is Bowie and Pitt. Bowie moving into Pitt's apartment with him for some time, socialising, going to the movies, going to the musical, went to see Oliver together, didn't they?
Right, okay. Well, I think we've covered Ken and hopefully done him a decent service there. And we're just going to read out a couple of paragraphs now from the Pitt report that Ken Pitt did. On my return from America and Australia, I'd given David the albums I'd bought him from New York, that of the Velvet Underground and a zany group I'd heard in Greenwich Village called the Fugs. He adored both of them, and particularly liked I'm Waiting for the Man on the former and Dirty Old Man on the latter, both of which he used in his act. This was the very first time he'd heard of Lou Reed, and such was his enthusiasm for the American artist that I was more interested than ever in bringing Andy Warhol and the Velvet Underground to Britain. What if they formed a mutual admiration society with Warhol and the Velvet singing David's praises in America?
That is great, isn't it?
Love that. Yeah, so forward-thinking. Brilliant.
Okay, again from the Pitt Report, this is Ken Pitt. There was, of course, a great deal of routine work to be done for David, but it was never dull because it was not without challenge. The smallest chore held great expectations of things to come. May the 5th was a typical day. 27 letters were sent to BBC radio and TV producers telling them about the forthcoming album, each letter being personal to the producer and individually typed. A demonstration tape Bowie had made of his song Love You Till Tuesday was sent to Peter Grant at Rack Records. A tape of three other songs of David's was sent to John Burgess, the titles being Going Down, Summer Kind of Love and Everything Is You. A letter was sent to the Friends Provident and Century Life offices about renewing the premium on David's life policy.
Blimey.
And the wording being, ask them if I can have an advance, David had said. A note was sent to Mark Exiger of Decca's Paris office telling him that David's parents were to spend a few days in Paris and would like to see him, and so on.
Okay, so this is where it takes a turn for the worst, at least for Ken Pitt. David and DeVries arrived promptly at 5. Both were dressed in the uniforms of their respective callings. David shaggy and satiny, DeVries neatly suited in brown, a conservative tie, his hair short and tidy. David sat on the chaise longue and stared straight ahead of him. He said nothing. DeFreeze said he was a lawyer who helped people in the music business, amongst them Tony Visconti. This led me to initially suspect that it was Visconti who had brought DeFreeze into the picture. Now that the lawyer was within the frame, I quickly realised that I was no longer looking at a portrait of David, but studying a broad landscape on which DeFreeze was a prominent feature in the foreground. David had still not uttered a word and remained sitting upright, his shiny eyes fixed on the wall in front of him. I made one or two pertinent remarks in an attempt to alert him to my worst fears, but he was beyond hearing. I formed the opinion that he was either stoned or posing as one who was. If a smile was seen to cross my face, it was because I'd been reminded of a doubtlessly malicious story I'd been told about Bob Dylan's management, who, it was alleged, kept him happily compliant in the country surrounded by hemp fields. Ooh. Perhaps all that had happened was that DeFreeze had ordered, "Don't say a word, I'll do all the talking." But I like to think that David had sought to reduce the pain of an unwelcome meeting.
That must have been a difficult moment for Ken Pitt.
Yeah, and you would think it would be pretty uncomfortable for Bowie as well, because they were very close and they'd done an awful lot for him. But as we know, Bowie was very ambitious, wasn't he? And
yeah,
so he'd gone for it.
Yeah. So we move on now. He says, I did not see David again until the 10th of May, 1973, by which time he'd finally achieved the great success for which he'd so long striven. He and Angela sprang a surprise on me by turning up on my doorstep in Manchester Street soon after their return from Japan. They both looked marvellous. We leapt into each other's arms and hugged and kissed and made such a commotion that the German nurse of the doctor on the ground floor looked out to see what was going on. Staring at David's red hair, pink flare trouser suit and yellow platform boots, she muttered, "Gott in Himmel," and quickly shut the door. All right, Angela, chic in black, sat herself on the lounge floor. David instinctively chose just the right setting for himself, the Victorian green velveted chaise longue. When he got up to make some coffee, I joined him in the kitchen, but it was as if he'd never been away. He knew exactly where to find the coffee, the crockery and spoons. This is great. He seemed to me to be a relaxed, more assured version of the old David. He asked about old friends and places he'd remembered and suggested we had dinner together one night. We took the coffee into the lounge and Angela asked if I'd like tickets for one of the Earl's Court concerts. "Yes," said David, "come and see what your boy is doing."
So that's sweet, and it's good to know that they did make up. And I don't know if they had any kind of future, you know, over the last few years of David's life. I can't imagine that they had too much cross-pollination, but you never know. No. Like I say, I mean, I did see Kevin Can, omnipresent, in the company of Ken Pitt at the opening, the preview, you like, of the David Bowie is at the V&A. And he did, he looked pretty frail at that point in time, but that was a good few years ago, and, you know, and he's still with us.
Yeah.
The A to Z of David Bowie was written and presented by Rob Hughes and Mark Riley and recorded and edited by Howard Knock. If you'd like to review or rate this podcast, well, that would be much appreciated. In the next episode...
The King Bees. Krautrock.
Stanley Kubrick.
The Kinks.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.